Hello, this is Dawn Walsh with the Montana Feminist History Project. I'm about to interview Carol Wicks Connick. Today is May the 11th, the year 2001. We are at Carol's home, which is 604 Gerald, Missoula, Montana, 59801. Okay, hello, Carol.
Hi.
Thanks for being here today. So I'd like to start out by asking you some personal background information, if you could just say where you were born, where you grew up, your education, you know, when you came to Montana, and a little bit about your growing up.
Okay, well, I'm a fifth generation Montanan, and so I probably have a lot of the pioneer spirit because one grandmother came by covered wagon to Montana and they homesteaded, and another one came up the Missouri to Fort Benton and over that way. And so my parents were all born here and through homesteads and different things. And so I was born in Missoula, and because my dad's parents moved over here and my mother came to the university here. And I was born, in fact, half a block away from where we're sitting right now, which is now an apartment house, but it used to be the old Elmore Hospital.
That's right.
And so I grew up here, went all the way through grade school and high school and college here. Mm-hmm. And so I've lived in Montana other than when I was first married. We did have a stint. He was in through our ROTC program in Germany. And we were at Fort Benton before that. And so, but basically I've lived in Montana and other parts of Montana. But through high school, I've always been a leader and involved in class offices and the student government. And my junior year, I went to the first girl state in Montana, which was in Billings at that time. And I think that gave me a good foundation in knowing that people can make change through legislative efforts, and not realizing how it was going to take me on down the road as much. But and I've always had family that have been very involved in their communities. My grandmother on my mother's side started the library at Libby, Montana. And my grandmother here on the other side played the pipe organ at the church, and, you know, and so you have people that have been very active and involved, including my mother, went to the university, and my dad too. So, and he later in his life, he and his father were in business here in Missoula, and then later in his life, he worked to help people who had addictions to the alcoholism. And I think working with people, which we always had people at our house, he would help them. He'd do what Claudia Black, 40 years in her book, did, you know, with interventions. My dad used to do that, and that was before there were any treatment centers in Montana. So I think a lot of my being part of was the wonderful women I had as in my life, and I always thought we already had equality of rights under the law, and because I never felt discriminated against. But and I can remember when the feminist movement first came on, you know, you were all being called bra burners and some of those things. And I looked up the word, and it says anyone who works with women's issues. And I thought, well, that's one thing we can also say. We're humanists, but we're also feminists, because we're definitely working for the betterment of women. And I've been doing that for many years now. And so that's how I feel it, that I had very strong role models and mentors in the women in my family, and to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how I really came to, I think the combination of the leadership, and I'd always be willing to do that. And I was on the Equal Rights Education Council in Great Falls. It was formed. And then when we were trying, the state of Montana was had passed. In fact, I testified on that. This was before 1977. Because I had gone to when I was a president of the YWCA board. I was on the board for 6 years in Great Falls, and about 1974, I went to a national convention down in. Of course, the YWCA tries to do all things for all women, so you get that reinforced also, mm-hmm. and to eliminate racism wherever you can. Mm-hmm. So we used to have racism audits and things like that. So I went to the national convention down in San Diego, where 3,000 women voted to say, yes, we want equality of rights under the law, and on the ERA. And so when we had passed it in the state of Montana under Article 2, Section 4 of our state constitution at the Constitutional Convention, where we got it in, that we would have it in Montana. But when we went to pass the national one, there was all these people would come in with their babies on their lap as if you couldn't have children. And so I got up and testified. That was the first time I testified in the legislature. Mm-hmm. And that would have been around 1975. And I testified that I had been to this national convention where I voted with 3,000 others that we wanted the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, that same year was the International Year of the Women. And I went to all the regional meetings like we're supposed to, and we were supposed to plan. What did we have, what could we do? And I had called, as public affairs chair of the YWCA during those 6 years, except the year I was president, I would call community-wide meetings to address problems, whether it was racism or whatever, with Malmstrom Air Force Base there. So in the International Year of the Woman in 1975, I had called a meeting, and we got everybody involved in going to the International Year of the Women in Helena when we were overtaken by the beehive symbol with their ballots that were, there were men that bussed in from Utah and other places, and were telling the women how to vote at this convention that had never gone to any of the regional meetings. And even a nun from Butte, Montana got up and said, because they commandeered the microphones and wouldn't let anyone even give a minority report, and there was a national woman, there was a Republican who came to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. And so, but they outvoted all of the delegates with all these regional meetings all over the state of Montana that we had. They commandeered the microphones and wouldn't let us get anything in, and they could outvote us because they brought in that many people. And they allowed men to come in. I asked one county extension agent from up around Shoto where his wife was. He said, well, she's pregnant, she's at home, I'm here. Well, he was voting on an International Year of the Woman, you mm-hmm. know. So they got their own list of people voted in, from Ann Allen from Great Falls down to Joan Zortmeyer from another part of the state. Mm-hmm. And so they all went to the national conference, none of the ones that had worked to get there but had mm-hmm. gone to it. So that kind of fires you up a little bit to work a little harder. And we had a protest march with it, and I did it with some of the representatives that were there, too, from the Montana legislature that happened to attend the International Year of the Woman, you know, trying to address issues that we cared about, whether it was health or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so then in 76, on as the one of the outcome of the international, well, and also, I was going to say the Equal Rights Amendment also, I think, helped us all over the state of Montana to get a real networking, cohesive group, because I got to know women from all over the state just when we would have get-togethers about that, you know. And but in 75, so I had Pat Roos, who's now she's with the Now Legal Defense Fund, and I think she still is. She was when we had the Carrying a Torch Ward in 95. And she'd started the Rape Crisis Line in Helena. And Pat Bartlett, who's been subsequent, she's a, you know, and all these women that I worked with the Montana Women's Lobby, then from down the road. But that wasn't until 82. I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit. But anyway, so we ended up, I called this community-wide meeting and had Pat Roos and Sue Bartlett from Helena to come over, and we formed a women's center, resource center, which we're just starting in different towns. Of course, the university here had one, and so we formed that. And we were getting that off the ground. The next year, I called the community-wide meeting, which was in January 20th, 1977. And I had called 150 agencies that dealt with abuse. And because Dorothy Eagy, who is the director of the YWCA, which is she was a wonderful mentor, and also had said, I'm seeing an increasing need for transient women, Carol. And so we put that on, too, abuse, because Salvation Army was doing some of the work with women that were transient, and so was the Rescue Mission. But then later, I got the Rescue Mission 10 years later to open up a place for women that are transient, because they don't need the secrecy as much. They need confidentiality, but they don't need the secrecy that you do with a battered women's shelter. But at first, when we opened it up, we were doing both. So I call this community-wide meeting of 150 agencies, and so we set up a task. We did a verbal and a written needs assessment at the YWCA, where I call the meeting. And we served lunch, so we'd get as many as we could there. And so anyway, we ended up forming this task force, and we were looking all around in every closet we could think of, how are we going to find a place for this shelter? And I got wind of the fact that Steve Waldron on House Bill 780 was about battered women, and his wife, by a former marriage, was in an abusive relationship. And so I called him up, and he had no idea anyone was trying to start a shelter. And so I said we would come over and testify. So we did, and the joint legislature had a joint resolution that said there should be a study on spouse battering. So that governor judge at that time set up an organization. Well, they actually, the study was then given to Crime Control to do, who in turn gave it to a Missoula attorney and Carol Mitchell, and Marty Adrian was a social worker, and they did the study over here in Missoula, you know. And so then from that, the state task force was set up, and it was set up from a systemic point of view, where you had law enforcement and judges and clerks and mental health and public health and people that were, they invited me to be on it because I was just starting this shelter. Mm-hmm. And so the first meeting we all had the study, and I have a copy of it here. The study that was done, and it was all, we put it in all the 40 public libraries in Montana, and so that was in April of 1978. And from that study, this task force, this we got the study the first meeting. The second meeting, one of the directors of Social and Rehabilitation Services said, Carol, we think you ought to chair the state task force. And I said, well, I'm already a volunteer executive director for Mercy Home and president of the board at the same time, because we had no funding, but we did have a spot that we were in this former, it was a orphanage at the five nuns had this big building that they had all kinds of programs in it, and they weren't using the upper floor at that time. And so for $50 a month, they, with lots of faith, they let us go in there to, you know, it was perfect. It had lots of closet room. We could bring in used clothing and, you know, and it had partition rooms. And I have some pictures I can show you of that. But anyway, he said, we need a civilian, not somebody that's working for the state of Montana, to chair this task force. And I said, well, I have to have a support staff, like a secretary that can send out the minutes. I said, I'm doing a lot right now anyway. And of course, I had three kids and whatnot and a husband. So anyway, so they gave me one of the top people in SRS, the Social Rehabilitation Services, to be able to do that, because they can't go for legislation. And so from that study, we were to report back to the legislature. So we, in the fall of that year, of 78, before them 79 legislature, and we testified in 77, and this is what happened. 79, we were to report back. In the fall of that year, we had a meeting, and we sent out a questionnaire to all the legislators, and we asked, would you support, oppose, sponsor, co-sponsor these laws? And the laws were, the Montana laws here. In 79, would you want me to read them, or just to say, okay?
To summarize them.
Okay. We could, because nobody was gaining any statistics on things, and it wasn't mandatory, but we asked the Department of Social and Rehabilitation Services, in cooperation with other agencies and officials like the county attorneys and people like that, to gather, maintain, and analyze statistics of spouse abuse for 4 years. Mm-hmm. That was the one of them. The other one was raise the marriage license fee, and which appropriated $72,000 per year for 2 years. That was the first money we did have, you know. And then we had to, even though we testified on it, and I testified on these 17 laws, and had 35 victim survivors, through those seven legislatures testify with me, from all over the state of Montana, through the programs all over the state by that time that we were doing. And so that was when we would get our, that's where we would write a grant to get some of the money, but that's how we first got it. And by the way, the other part of the marriage license fee, part of it goes to the judge's retirement fund, just for your edification. And Senate Bill 409 was the revised law relating to assault between spouses. It abolished the common law doctrine of interspousal tort immunity for assaults and intentional torts, so that an abused spouse could sue a spouse for damages incurred as a result of abuse. It also eliminated the exclusion regarding rape between spouses if they were living apart, whether under a decree of judicial separation or otherwise, because, you know, you couldn't do that then. And of course, that came out of that study. That's why we went for these particular laws. The other one, Senate Bill 243, changed the procedures for granting a temporary restraining order without notice to the adverse party if the delay would cause immediate or irreparable damage to the applicant. Well, in an abuse cases, you can't notify them that they're going to be getting a restraining order. You don't get them served, you know. So that's what happened in 77. And then in 81, of course, in the meantime, we were working with having people like Dr. Lenora Walker, who has done one of the most research on battered women, and her book I have here, you know, for you to look at. You know, we would have workshops in Montana, and then we, as volunteers from all the programs, because I gave 60 talks and workshops every year. And I kept thinking, I won't have to do this next year, but every year. And then I would do it out to Kremlin and and Haver and different places. And the Law Enforcement Academy even had a Mercy Home workshop team. By that time, I had gotten Jesuit volunteers. It was called Creative Staffing. I had Jesuit volunteers who were, you didn't have to be a college graduate, but most all of them were. And so they would give a year of service, you know, for oppressed and people in abusive situations or whatever. They worked with them. Some of them worked for food banks, etc. Anyway, so we got them involved too, so that a lot of the people in here are some of my Jesuit volunteers who would testify and write testimony. We had all the women's empower themselves by writing testimony and testifying. And some of them went on to do all kinds of things, you know. So that has been, so when you empower somebody else, and even some of the children wrote letters, I don't want to see my mom and dad going through this, and please pass this law, you know. And so what we told them, it was important if they couldn't testify that they would let them know why we needed to change that law. And so then, of course, Lenore Walker, and when she gives talks, would go into the patriarchy of domestic abuse and develop it and why. So that is why we've had some of the things we've had, you know, but I'm not going into that totally. But we changed the procedure in 81 for granting a temporary restraining order whereby the applicant does not have to file for separation or divorce. And here, they're not ready to do that when they first come into a shelter, and they may not be able to do that for a long time, and maybe they're, you know, but we have to change the law to allow people that that's a possibility, that they don't have to file a divorce action to get a restraining order. Okay. In House Bill 800, we raised the fee again a little bit more to get a little more for shelters and safe homes programs for victims of spouse abuse.
Okay. And before we go too much ahead, I want to come back and stay around 1977. And so can you comment, of course we know spousal abuse, domestic violence has just happened for a long time, if not
yes,
forever.
Yes, it's for centuries.
Right, right. Right. But there was a new level of discourse that began to happen at this time period. And so
When we did it, we had no idea anyone else in the United States was doing it. And when I went to the first National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and that would have been in 1981, they had you stand up when you started your shelter. And we were one of 30 shelters in the whole United States at that time. So it was just, we were really in on the ground floor of the shelter movement. And Grace Sycott in Butte, Montana, had also opened up this, what they called a safe home, which they couldn't take in children. So then a couple years later, she and one of the sisters over there came over. I just had been to a National Coalition Against Domestic Violence conference where I learned how you could get a HUD house. We had a shelter, but they didn't in Butte. And so they were able to, I was able to give them the book and the grant and to tell them how to go about it. And so they got a shelter started in Butte then. But I would go to Billings and help. I did technical assistance too with, Missoula was the second one. Billings was the third. Butte was about the fourth. Later was, Haver was able to start because they started Highline Help for Abuse Spouses. So it was all this education we were doing through churches anywhere we could, in all these 60 workshops and talks to just different groups, and people would say to me, oh, I wish we'd had this before. My cousin would still be alive, or whatever, you know. And so we hadn't, until Lenore Walker, about that same time, was starting to do a study, and that's how it was starting to go, that people were, you know, since then, when she did it, there were Del Martin also written the Battered Wives book, but it was just barely starting, and so it was really a grassroots movement.
And again, could you clarify how you got into the domestic violence movement. You were already active in many ways as a
yeah.
community member, but then
yeah.
how did you get into this specific issue?
Well, because how I got into it was because I called a community-wide meeting. And, well, my background's in social work and
okay.
psychology, and so I always knew I would be working in a social service type field, even though I was in this other business of developing a resort at Flathead Lake earlier on. But so I always knew that I would be, and because that was my field of study. And but at that time, we had no mention of a battery or anything, you know. And so so a lot of the laws that we were ending up passing also helped people in other in abuse in families, you know, of child or other people, that sort of thing. We elder abuse things started to come out more and more after we did the battered women's movement.
And so what was your...
But I also, I think, what was what? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you about your take on... sort of a larger community response to this issue being brought to the table, if you will.
Well, I think having started with 150 agencies, because the Mercy Home Task Force, I said anybody that wants to be on the board can be on it, and it was comprised of people from the Native American Center, from HUD, from SRS, it was in mental health, because these were people that I'd originally called, and they wanted to see something happen with it too, and none of us realizing the enormity of the problem. And but I think all of the work that I had done up to that time with being involved with the YWCA and everything put me in the right place at the right spot to do it. And because I did include, she told me emergency shelter for women and children. But that's not the same thing as abused women and children, so I had put in that. And that's how it started. And when I said to the YWCA board, I said, don't you want this as your program? And they said, Carol, you have such good community support. And I did. And so I think by that it helped to really get it started. You know, when I'd get a little money here, I think, well, that'll pay for the electricity this month, sort of thing, until I could start writing grants. And the first grant I did through the Presbyterian Church Women's Opportunity Giving Fund, a $30,000 grant. And then that first year after we... 79, then that fall I could write a grant to help fund the director's salary, so that's when I was able to become salaried to continue on. I thought, I've done all this work to this point, I can't see it. I'm learning and we're studying, and I had through the years master's level women doing internships there. I had over 100 nursing interns from MSU, college interns from the College of Great Falls at that time. It's now the University of Great Falls. So I had wonderful staffing. I had professional mental health workers doing a support group for the women, volunteering that time. You know, plus some of them went into counseling over and above that. A lot of them did that with all different agencies. You worked through United Way, you became a United Way agency, and I was able to, at the second shelter, that when they ended up tearing down the building we were in, we had to move, and I was able to help get some funding to help their building because of the other client load we were doing through community development block grants and things. So I was really working for a lot of other agencies and working together. If we couldn't have done what we did without the crisis line that was already formulated, and they just started receiving all kinds of calls, of course, when we started that. So I think the systemic approach with you get everybody you can, and we worked real closely with law enforcement, you know, to help the women, and we go into their homes to get any clothing or whatever, you know, and just so that we kept growing and doing that and working with him. And that's why I got involved, because mm-hmm. that's calling it and starting the shelter. And then I just thought, I need to continue on and do this. Mm-hmm. So every aspect we could do, you know. And we didn't provide just a shelter. We did everything we could in helping them decide what was the best course for them, you know, letting them understand the problem. We had them all read the books. We had support groups. We had, we'd help them with housing and work or schooling. We'd have children that were even homeschooled in the shelter that maybe were in, they just moved from Billings. I'm thinking of a family. We networked with all the other shelters that eventually started in the state, and we worked with all the Indian tribes. I can remember I had a grant from out of Washington, D.C. once, mm-hmm. and he came to review the shelter, you know, after a year or so, and that I had, you know, five different women from different Indian tribes around Montana there at the same time he was there. And to me, working closely with them, it was wonderful, because some of them were able to get some of the laws we passed in the state of Montana into their tribal laws. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean, how you can...
So I'll ask a question. So can you talk specifically about what it was like when the shelter opened then?
Yeah. Well, we even had an open house, actually, would you believe, when we did it. And then we said it was secret. Nobody could know where it was. But we were up on the third floor of this... building that the nuns were in charge of, and we had these five little angels guarding over us. It used to spook me when the kids would go down the fire escape, you know, as one way we sometimes have to use when these little babies go down there, you know. You felt safe, I guess, because they were there. And occasionally, I'll never forget Sister Grace talking to this one man that wanted to find his wife, and she said, I think you need to quit drinking and go get some help, you know. And only she was really nice to her. But anyway, many women have been threatened to be killed, so you do really need to know. I noticed now, in today's society, some of the shelters are saying where they are, but mm-hmm. there's still some threats. I mean, you have to be very careful about it. So we were very careful. We'd hide cars. We would get the dogs or cats to the Humane mm-hmm. Society or somebody that would take them. We did everything we could to give that person time to do some healing and learn some different ways to work. And we did, like I say, the support groups for the children and support groups for the women. Later on, I had foster grandmothers to work with the children. Everything I could to have them learn what other ways. One of my staff developed a nonviolent coloring book right mm-hmm. away. We didn't allow any spanking. We did timeouts, and we told them that it's not allowed here. And the kids thought, oh, great, I can't be spanked, you know. But we taught them, you know, that there's other ways to solve conflict than to hitting, and mm-hmm. that's what spanking is hitting. Well, no, that was a traditional way so many of us were raised. Mm-hmm. But the rod was to lead the sheep with, not to hit with, you know. Anyway, that's mm-hmm. People used to say, spare the rod, you spoil the child, but that's mm-hmm. not true. And so timeouts really do work. Mm-hmm. I even, with my own grandchildren, have said when they were little, do you want a timeout? No, Grandma, no. Anyway, what I think is that the courage of the women, the nuns, and the fact that they've been pioneers in their way, and I even had some nuns that went on with me on the Equal Rights Education Council mm-hmm. on the television. So I've had a lot of association with other women wanting equality of rights mm-hmm. under the law and working for women's issues. Yeah. And I definitely feel the battered women movement is working for women's issues. And I guess that's why I got the women helping women awards from the Soroptimus and different ones, and I got a Jefferson Award also for outstanding public service. So, but you know, so to me, it's the women themselves, though, that you gain from, and the courage that they have to testify in the legislature. And we did it right away. We had them do it right away, you know, at the very beginning, because they needed to see, why do we need to change those laws? Mm-hmm. And I have some wonderful legislative stories about the humor that the women legislators that I have in here, that I have pictures of that I worked with, Senator Pat Regan, the different ones, Nancy Keenan, and I'm just naming names you might have heard.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you want to tell one of those stories?
Well, sure. We were on the marital, making domestic abuse a criminal offense, I think, when this woman came over, married a fellow from the Air Force and came over from England, had sold her house in England, and put it into a new home that they had, and of course he locked her out of it, and mm-hmm. she ended up being in public housing on the floor with her kids on a mattress. To, you know, she came in because she had a job, and so right away I asked her down the road. I would always each year think, now this would be a good law to go for, and this person would be a good person if she'd be willing to go over and testify. We had to be very careful because many of them were still in very abusive situations. Mm-hmm. And so that we would sometimes ask somebody like Nancy Keenan or Senator Pat Regan when they were carrying a law, would you use just, well, we would have them, they could use their, maybe a name, you know, that wasn't theirs, or just a first mm-hmm. name or whatever, mm-hmm. just so it wouldn't be published in the paper, you know, to protect them. Well, anyway, we had gone, and she had taken her daughter's picture, who was then 3 years old, and said, and put it in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and said, this is who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I had gone with her when she had to exchange and let this man who had an alcohol and abuse problem take this child on a visitation, and just scared her to death because, mm-hmm. you know, drinking and driving and the whole bit, and let alone what else. And I told her, I said, Rosemary, we're going to go down now before the Senate convenes, and I want you to get a hold of Senator so-and-so from Weibo County, and I won't use any name. I didn't tell her, well, he's never passed anything on women's rights. In fact, Senator Pat Regan would give him the pink, the little pink pig.
Miss Piggy?
No. What's the word I want? Chauvinistic pig.
Oh, chauvinistic pig.
Anyway, I didn't tell her that he'd never voted for anything. Anyway, she went up to him and asked him, you know, I'd say, go ask him why he would not support this and find out. And he said, oh, I know all about violence. I was in World War II. To which she replied with a beautiful English accent, well, my father fought in the trenches in France for 6 years to make me free, not so some man would batter me. When she told me that, I said, Rosemary, that is absolutely wonderful. I said, you couldn't have said anything better. He went back, got everybody on the Senate Judiciary to vote for it. I mean, this is a person that, you know, but it was, this is the kind of thing they did. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fabulous. And so I'm happy to say she is remarried to the most wonderful man, and her little 3-year-old daughter was at the 20th anniversary of Mercy Home when I gave a talk back in Great Falls a couple years ago, and they were there. And so, and I called them up and I said, I'd sure like to have you guys there.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Anyway, but that was just one of the many, because, like I say, they bared their souls and told about threatening to be killed and their testimony. I've got all of it because I made up packets, and I would hand it to all the legislators on the committee because, you know, just to have that impact. Then I would take those same packets and send them to all of our congressmen and senators in the Congress, it took 10 years to pass the Domestic Violence Prevention and Services Act. But that's how these people impacted the Montana law and eventually helped impact the laws.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good work.
So
I want to jump ahead quite a bit now because we have only a certain amount of time, and I do want to have you tell us about the Silhouette Project, which I know you were involved in and which was a very significant project. So do you want to talk about how that got started?
Yeah, the national initiative. It was a national initiative, and the vision is to have no more homicides and domestic violence, to promote peace, healing, and responsibility in adult relationships in order to eliminate domestic murders in the United States by the year 2010. And so when this vision started with some women that were art majors in Minnesota, the Silent Witness, the Silhouettes did, and Jerry Miller was president of the State Business and Professional Women that year, and she and Vicki Amundson, who was the incoming president that year, who is Clark Fork Realty, she's been on the Lobby Fund board and, you know, been in Business and Professional Women many years. They had gone back to the national, and when many of the national BPW states were deciding to be part of it. And so Jerry asked Vicki if she wanted to do it, and she said, let's go for it. And so Vicki had the first three figures made. She had her son over at the Sigma Neuhaus help with them, and she had some other friends that have built a lot of them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe that they were... and she took them back October 18th of 97, I think, because this was our state convention when we had them here. And these are just the women in Montana that have been killed since 1990. We now have 40, I'm sad to say. In 93, I retired from Southgate Mall. I moved back to Missoula in 90, and I tried to get into my field, but I thought everybody's going to think I'm going to be retiring in a few years, which I wasn't planning to. But unbeknownst to me, I didn't know I was going to get remarried either. So we were snowbirds. So I was going down when Vicki took them to the national, I probably had gone with her and marched, because I marched down the streets of Denver way back when Andrea Dworkin gave a talk and on the violence against rape. And we marched 3,000 of us down the streets of Denver yelling 2, 4, 6, 8, no more violence, no more rape, you know.
And when was that?
That was back in 1978. Right after I'd started Mercy Home, I went to a national conference down in Denver on violence and rape. So it was very natural for me to end up just this last year when I was back here in Missoula in the wintertime, because I was still involved in BPW all this time, here, and that's our local, state, national project, you know. So we're the ones that started the Silent Witness in Montana, and she gets them around to everybody. We were just at a crime victims fair with all the providers from all over the state in Helena at the Law Enforcement Academy. And the Silent Witness Initiative Board that I'm on now is also doing workshops with psychologists and social services to some of the more recent things, to how do we re-educate and help the abuser to have self-mastery, or the Stasny model, or the different models that they're presenting in workshops too. And the Montana Coalition is in Helena with an office, which was our dream for years when we'd had a coalition person there. You know, we did state education and training. We've constantly done it for years. So all of these things contribute to everything that we've done before. And it's pretty impressive when you see those figures, you know. And it was interesting at the crime victim in Helena, some of the law enforcement, one of the law enforcement men up, and he saw this figure and he said, "Oh my gosh, that's my wife's aunt."
Mm-hmm.
It really took him back to see her there in silhouette figure. And so, and we, the pay equity day we had at the mall this year, we had one of the figures that represented 39 figures at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to be proven that, you know, and it has to have been a proven case. It isn't just, but there again, when we talked with our new Attorney General, Mike McGrath, and we're saying we need to be able to, you know, have some cohesive statistics, because we read it in the paper that it happened in Billings, Montana, or Livingston, or somewhere, you know. And this was at our state convention when the first year after she went there, that we had the figures. And it's interesting, I went out into the other room where they were putting they have the women's name on, how old she was, who she was killed by.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to do healing for the families too, to feel like their figures going around and seeing that. We just took them up the Justices of Peace, because some of them say, well, she doesn't need any restraining order. And that's one of, we did the self-help restraining order back in 1985, the same time we made it a criminal offense in the state of Montana, and the same time we did the murder rape law in the state of Montana. Worked with the women from the Women's Law Caucus. I've always worked with legal services, because they were on the initial spouse battering task force that the governor appointed, and they helped me. They would do research. Well, then when the women from the Women's Law Caucus came in, you know, and we would have somebody from Billings, one of the men carried that law, and we'd all walk in with our briefcases and stuff, and you could see them visibly step back. So just people going in and saying, you know, this is why we need to change. And I used to take the women that testified into one of the senators or representatives' office and say, we just wanted to come in and see what if you have any problems with this particular legislation, or here's a packet of the testimony we just gave to the Senate Judiciary or the House Judiciary Committee or whatever, and sit there and talk with them. And so it's what you call trying to educate the legislation as to why we need to have women helping women and being able to go ahead in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
can you, you mentioned an encounter with the law enforcement who saw his wife's aunt. Can you share, if you could share a story or two about encounters that you've seen happen with the silhouettes?
Well,
or some, you know, some more personal interactions with the silhouettes.
Well, I had a woman that I had my, someone had said she should come and meet me, and I said we were going to have this down at the courthouse in October. We always have it down there. In fact, Judy Wang, who's done so much here locally with the Family Violence Council, had given us she's helped with a lot of the current laws that were just in this last legislature. And she gave us a plaque that Vicki Amundson had gotten for the State Business Freshman Women because of the project. But anyway, of course, she knew this one figure from her hometown. And of course, she won. I said, "Do you want me to take a picture with you?" And she cried, and I cried. Crying's an emotion. You cry when you're happy, you cry when you're sad. And so when they cry, I'd cry. So anyway, it's a lot of release, you know. But she has blossomed forth already because she has met the people that care about the problem, other feminists, you might say, and you get them in BPW. And but more than that, it feels like a support system too, without it being a group type therapy type thing, you know. And this is what we all need one way or another. You want to have friends that help you in whatever situation you're in. So it's very emotional. And I've heard remarks, young men going through out the door, what are they trying to prove about guns, you know, this kind of thing, you know, which they're not getting the message at all. And so most of them are very good, are very compassionate, and, you know, because it happens in all economic, all income levels, all socioeconomic levels, and so we learned all those things, and the women are most dangerous, in danger, I should say, when they do leave. I had a detective break into my house from another town that was looking for his wife, and he called me about it, and I said, "I can't tell you whether she's here or whether she's not here," you know. So you had all kinds of things happen, and, you know, and that's the only incident I ever had anything like that. And what he did to his little daughter, you know, and that's how they track them. They use the children to try to get them back. I think there's a great response to it. I think it raises a conscious level, and people don't want to think that that's really true, you know. But I think that the more we do that kind of thing, and doing it at a law enforcement academy was great because all those trainees were there, and And I always protected them. I always said, "This guy has a gun dealership. He gets it through the mail. He carries a pistol in his leg," and he, you know. And I was always warning them, you know, to protect the law enforcement that were going out and risking their lives to, you know. But they, because the modern thing when I first started the shelter was, you know, the law enforcement was trained to tell them to take a walk around the block. And they come back and really give it to them, you know. And so, for many reasons. So, I feel that the women have really made the difference in helping to change the laws and to change their own lives. These two did a remarkable thing, and everybody in this picture. This is Steve Waldron. This is Governor Swindon, excuse me, signing the marital rape law into law.
And again, that was 19...
I don't have the date on this, do I? Yeah, 85 was this when we did those laws. And and then we get into all kinds of... I did a lot of legal advocacy and testified in 10 different district courts on spouse battery. And with the, you know, clients I worked for. So you can see that you have to do the education and tell people why we need the laws and the quality of those laws. It was quite an experience to have done the legislation, and what has been pleasing to me is some of the women like Vivian Brooke that have continued on when she was in the legislature with laws, and all of them, you know, that here in Missoula that we know. And so I've always been very politically involved too since then, because you know the people that are in these offices. When you go over and testify, you get to know a lot of these people. And it's real interesting in putting a law through. And it was so, it's real interesting for those women. And there's a lot of other stories I could tell you, but about them, and how we kept the Supreme Court from changing, recodifying something that we had passed into law, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway. Okay. So I feel that that you just keep telling people that we have to work with women, helping women, and do it through just saying it like it is, mm-hmm. and that why we have to change that, and if one person can make that difference. Because this young woman I was telling you about that recently went and saw the figures and then revealed that she herself had been in a very abusive situation. And she was even talking to me about testifying, you know, so just to let people know, or writing a book about it and what she went through. And that's what it's going to take to change that. But to doing projects like you are... lets us know that how we can work together, you know, and get the word out.
So you have seen a lot of change occur in the last 30 years on this issue,
mm-hmm.
and as we know, it's not over, and there's still a lot more work to be done, but to me, right now, sort of talking a little philosophically, you know, you seem to have a great deal of hope still,
mm-hmm.
and a great deal of energy and faith that
mm-hmm.
yourself as well as other women will continue this issue,
mm-hmm.
and it will continue to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So could you just reflect on that, the process of change in this arena, and where you think we're going, and about the hope that you have in this
yeah.
area?
Well, and then we always did education, not only in to the adults in the workshops I gave, but I had my staff all do it in the high schools and junior highs. I had VISTA volunteers too for several years, and they would go into the junior high level. Here in Missoula, they're doing it through puppetry, and so to me, that's where with kids you teach how kids not to do, because all they see on TV is bang, bang, kill, kill, you know. I think the violence on the television and things, I can see why they are asking them to, you know, can't we have a few more Ozzie and Harry type, or, you know, I know we're, that isn't nearly as exciting as shoot them up and crush them around and whatnot, but it's, we need to do that. I'm a little amazed the number of homicides, you know, because we were trying to work ourselves out of a shelter. We hope to
mm-hmm.
improve that. But, it, so, because I have no record. Of course, we weren't reporting the homicides as domestic abuse like we are now. But I just feel that this will eventually, you know, be the thing that will change that. I think it already has. And I don't think women today, I mean, we tried to, like in the high school level, I can remember one of my Jesuit volunteers who went out to this small high school outside of Great Falls and gave a talk right before graduation. And these several of the senior girls, one of the teachers told me after the fact, broke off their wedding plans because she had told them about the red flags. And this is a very loving young woman, that with this Jesuit volunteer, But she went out, and having worked at the shelter, these women would never work in a shelter, probably, you know. And I thought that was wonderful, that they saw right then. And that's what we try to tell people. It's kind of like the date rape thing, where you try to educate the women. And so I think we're educating the women that, you know, this is not okay behavior. And if you see some red flags, like total possessiveness, power and control over you, you better start looking at a different angle of it, you know. So I do feel the education we're doing is going to eventually bring it to a much better conclusion. So
we're just have a couple minutes left. If there's anything you want to say before the tape is over, some closing remarks.
Well, I'm really feel that I'm proud of the fact that you all are doing a project, a feminist history project. I think it's wonderful that we can do an oral history. We used to do that. The Native Americans still do it, right? A lot. Although they're probably writing down theirs more, yeah, too. But to do it now, and so that we can give our thoughts on it. And I really do feel that we can do a lot of changes, and have women have always been pretty involved in their communities and help start the water quality things and other assets, you know, or other parts of the community and for themselves. And since they're where we really had the women's movement, and we deal with issues like pay equity and everything else, like in business and professional women, that's one of our big things. We just, in the mall, sold cookies to $1 for men and 75 cents for women. And a lot of young women came and said, "That is so wonderful that you're doing that."
That's great.
Anyway, and this one gentleman had three daughters there, and he said, "Well, I've been trying to tell him that's the way it is." And the one of his daughters told me, she said, "Well, I've been washing dishes." She was in high school, and she said, "And there's a guy that washes dishes too, and he does get paid more than I do." And he said, "See, I told you." Anyway, I think that we are going to be able to have a little bit more of an equality of rights under the law, and I would like to see that passed in the Congress totally. I mean, we had 37, you know, we needed 38 states to do it. And so, but it's still a thing that we're working.